Old Testament Premium Podcast number 46 on Isaiah. I bring you greetings from Korea. I've just left Singapore, also Bangladesh and India. I'm on an Asian speaking tour. Whatever part of the world you're in, I pray that this podcast will be useful to you and strengthen your walk with God. Before I begin, I'd like to mention that, as usual, the structure of the podcast, that is, the outline I'm using, is not in the notes that I provide. The accompanying notes are simply further study ideas, devotionals for children, key verses, and so forth. So you really do have to listen to the podcast to get the structure and the main points. There are always many things in the notes that will not be mentioned in the podcast, and I hope you'll take advantage of those, using them together to maximize learning. We're going to talk about the prophet Isaiah, who's sometimes called the prince of the prophets, not just for coming in first position in the way the Bibles are laid out, but also for the incredible emphasis in this book on holiness. The call of Isaiah, which we'll be looking at in a moment, is a call to holy living. He's the most quoted prophet in the New Testament. In fact, even in the Dead Sea Scrolls, he's the most quoted. In fact, there are 19 Isaiah scrolls. Two of them are complete, and the most famous one with all those messianic prophecies, well, you got it. That's 1Q Isaiah A. That's the most famous Dead Sea Scroll in the world, the prince of the prophets. And according to Isaiah 1:1, he prophesied for many decades during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Tradition has it that he lived into the early years of Manasseh when he died. More about that in a moment. Isaiah was a family man. There was a Mrs. Isaiah. Possibly she was a prophetess. That's not clear. It's ambiguous. And he had at least three sons whose symbolic names are fraught with meaning. There's Shear Yashuv, which is a remnant will return. There's Mahashalal Chashbaz, swift to the plunder, quick to the spoil, or something like that. And there's Immanuel, which is God with us. I'd like to begin in Isaiah chapter 6. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." At the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. When the prophet says he saw the Lord seated on a throne, we understand that this is a vision. No one can truly or fully see God. But in the vision, the Lord is seated on a throne. And Isaiah is so small in comparison that it's just the end of the robe of the Lord, the train of his robe, that fills the temple. And the temple's not small. Go to 1 Kings 6 and see the dimensions. But part of the robe of the Lord is simply filling it, which means to see the Lord, Isaiah would have had to look up very, very high. It's an awesome vision. It's awe-inspiring. Not like, wow, cool. Oh no, much more unsettling than that. The enormous cosmic vision is more unsettling than thunder, earthquake, or fire. It's simply terrifying. Isaiah was overwhelmed. He doesn't react flippantly. He doesn't say, "Hey, cool, let's give a high five." Nor does he speak flippantly to Yahweh. He is overwhelmed, and we would be too. I remember a time when I was a fairly young Christian. There was a spectacular thunderstorm. And I remember I lay in bed. I was thinking thoughts a Christian shouldn't be thinking. And there was a thunderbolt that was so close to me, I felt as though it were nearly intended for me. And it wasn't that I thought God was out to get me, but I thought I could die. I remember I got up and I stayed up the rest of the night praying. It was just sheer terror. "Woe to me," I cried, "I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty." Isaiah is truly overwhelmed. I think also of Daniel and John the Revelator, who could hardly breathe in the presence of divinity. We, in contrast, have a very cavalier attitude, sometimes encouraged even through the songs that we sing. The whole earth is full of his glory. And of course, he could not be contained in the temple, even though it's filled with smoke, filled with the incense, filled with his presence. The revelation of the Lord is terrible. Terrible in the original sense of terror, that is, a complete and deep embracing and gripping fear. To meet the Lord face to face would be not just fun or inspiring. There would be an element of abject fear. The Lord is the true King. Isaiah sees that he's the true King. Now that's really important in the context of the book of Isaiah. And we're not going to be studying too much the theology of Isaiah. We're looking in this series at the characters of the people, in this case the prophet himself. But it says the Lord is the true King. One of Isaiah's major messages is that we shouldn't be intimidated by what's going on in the world. Not to be intimidated by the superpowers. At this time, in the 8th century BC, Assyria was on the rise. The Neo-Assyrian Empire, they're coming back. They were intimidating everybody. They're invading. They're flexing their political and military muscles. And Isaiah's message is not to put faith in alliances and treaties and politics. There was a resistance movement afoot. A movement that said, well, let's be linked with Egypt or some other nations, and we'll go against the flow. We will reject Assyria. And Isaiah is saying, do not join this movement. Do not take these political steps. Now, we'll have more on this in a moment. At any rate, Isaiah feels unworthy. Then one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, which he had taken from tongs. With tongs from the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." And then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I. Send me." Isaiah experiences the cleansing grace of God. God who longs to be gracious to us all. Isaiah 30, verse 18. He's cleansed. Then and only then is Isaiah ready to proclaim the word. And his grace was not without effect, as with Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, as with you and me in Titus chapter 2. "Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I. Send me." I remember in the many months during which I was slowly coming to faith, I was terrified to share with others. And eventually, when I experienced the goodness of the Lord and his cleansing touch, I was transformed. And I imagine many of you were as well. Now, instead of being afraid of people, you may still have been nervous, I know I was, but now we had more fear of the Lord. And because of that, we were ready to go, but not until we've been cleansed, not until our lips had been touched. Isaiah realizes that he lives among a people of unclean lips. I became bolder. Isaiah went out and preached for decades. I pray that if you're a Christian, man or woman, that you can experience or re-experience this call of God, because God's presence and spirit are truly transforming. Now, some of you listening to this live in the former British Commonwealth, and you're saying, "Douglas, why are you saying Isaiah?" Well, that's true. In the British English, it's Isaiah. However, we're really all wrong, because in the Hebrew, it's Yeshayahu. So no one's really saying it right, as is the case with most biblical names. So let's not get hung up on that. The message of the prophet is a call to holiness. And as with all the prophets, they're alternating oracles of judgment and hope. And these oracles can rapidly cycle, and it's like the channel gets changed very quickly, and it can be hard to follow. But as you read Isaiah, you'll see this. The message of judgment is that God will use pagan nations to punish the people of God if necessary. Just as the Assyrians take the northern kingdom of Israel, much of the southern kingdom, and eventually the Babylonians finish off the job. But there's also a message of hope that after the Babylonian exile, the Persians will return the people to the land. They'll return the Jews to the Holy Land. And yet, the message of hope is not just for them, it's for every nation. And you'll see oracles in this book addressed to Moab, to Syria, Egypt, Ammon. It's a long list of nations. So what that means is the goal is not prosperity, the good life, national sovereignty. No, the goal is that the Lord will be our true sovereign, that spiritually we will prosper. And in the next chapter, chapter 7, Isaiah challenges King Ahaz, who's intimidated by the Assyrians, and he challenges the king. Some think that Isaiah is from a royal family himself. He has some royal blood, very possible. He certainly seems to have access to the kings. But he challenges Ahaz to be calm. Calm your nerves. Ahaz is lacking in confidence, inexperienced, young, and very influenced by the temptation to put his faith in the military and in politics. And Isaiah says, don't do it, just as he challenges Israel not to do it. I'd like to read a fairly curious episode in Isaiah's life. This is in chapter 20. And if you've read Isaiah before, you'll certainly remember it. Hopefully we can give a bit more explanation. In the year that the supreme commander, sent by Sargon, king of Assyria, came to Ashdod, okay, that's in the area of the Philistines, and attacked it and captured it. At that time, the Lord spoke through Isaiah, the son of Amoz. He said to him, take off the sackcloth from your body and the sandals from your feet. And he did so, going around stripped and barefoot. Then the Lord said, just as my servant Isaiah has gone stripped and barefoot for 3 years, as a sign and portent against Egypt and Cush, so the king of Assyria will lead away stripped and barefoot the Egyptian captives and Cushite exiles, young and old, with buttocks bared, to Egypt's shame. Those who trusted in Cush and boasted in Egypt will be afraid and put to shame. And that day, the people who live on this coast will say, see what has happened to those we relied on, those we fled to for help and deliverance from the king of Assyria. And we'll just stop there. Like all the prophets, this man's life was colorful, dangerous, on the wild side. He led a colorful life that was personally intertwined with the message he was given to deliver. And what was this message? He's urging Judah not to put trust in this, in the Egyptian government for an alliance, or the Cushites. The Cushites are what would be called the area, the Upper Nile, or the Northern Sudan. He's saying, don't put your hope in them. I'd like to read one excerpt right now from Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel's book, The Prophets. And he talks about the way the people of God can be tempted to get sucked in to the political world. Heschel says, the prophets, questioning man's infatuation with might, insisted not only on the immorality, but also on the futility and absurdity of war. A less powerful nation, an oppressed people, may be tempted to take things into their own hands. I've stopped reading Heschel. This is me talking. And the irony that Heschel actually points out is that when the revolutionaries get power, they usually end up becoming as bad as the people they replace. Now, this is how Heschel puts it. It is the bitter irony of history that the common people, who are devoid of power and are the prospective victims of its abuse, are the first to become the ally of him who accumulates power. Power is spectacular, while its end, the moral law, is inconspicuous. Well, this is the message. The true power is the Lord himself, and we mustn't be awed by political power. We mustn't put our hope in that. That's a strong Old Testament theme. Now, I said this is a curious passage. Well, he removes the sackcloth from his body. You'd say, well, what was he? Was he mourning? Well, I think that was a pretty common way prophets would dress. And he exchanges that for the garb of a slave. It says buttocks bared. Well, what are we talking about? We're saying that he's just wearing a loincloth. He has no shoes, no sandals. He's dressed in the garb of a slave who's working. This is what the Egyptians will look like after the war. And there was a war in 713 to 711 BC. And it doesn't look like Judah joined it. So in this case, Isaiah's message was influential. In short, that's what will happen if we don't put our hope in God, but we trust the armor of flesh, we trust men. We'll end up being reduced to a lowly state. It seems Judah listened to Isaiah. That's unusual. And again, Isaiah consistently emphasized the Lord is the true king. Another thing that certainly emerges in this passage is his humility. Can you imagine if the Lord said, I want you to not wear your normal clothes, boy, it feels like going out in your underwear. Just wear a loincloth and you're dramatizing the fate of any who reject God's sovereignty and put his hope in politics. Can you imagine walking around dressing that way? It's hard for me to imagine doing it even one day. And Isaiah did it for 3 years. He was willing to be used by God. However, there's the humility. Well, we see other interactions with Isaiah, and you can read this on your own, in chapters 37, 38, and 39. He interacts with Hezekiah and strengthens King Hezekiah. He's the one who delivers the message that Hezekiah is going to die. And Hezekiah prays fervently. We looked at him in a previous podcast. God gives him an extension, and Isaiah walks back and says, you have 15 more years. Also, when Hezekiah later becomes a bit complacent and shows the Babylonians, the new rising power, the treasures of the temple and the palace, Isaiah is certainly right there. So he has this access to royal power. He speaks the truth. He has great courage. And he is not intimidated by propaganda. Now, we could talk more about propaganda, but the Assyrian king, I'll just say something brief. The Assyrian king, who through his field marshal tried to intimidate the people in Jerusalem, you may remember the Rabshakeh, the field marshal, is shouting out in their language, and the people on the wall say, please don't speak. Don't speak in that language. We can use the other language. And he says, no, everyone needs to hear it. So he intimidates with propaganda, but soon after, the king of Assyria himself is intimidated by a rumor. I think it's that the Ethiopians had invaded. And then he ends up leaving and being struck down in his own land. He's actually killed by two of his sons. So when we start playing this political game, we become very sensitive to pressures and currents and propaganda, and it's just worldly. We've got to trust the Lord. Isaiah's courage is proverbial. Well, it's actually shocking. Because according to Jewish tradition, and this is also in Christian, early Christian tradition, Isaiah met his death in the reign of Manasseh by being sawed in two. And this was obviously before Manasseh repented. We had a podcast on him. But in most of his years, he was completely ungodly. The story is that he was sawn in two with a wood saw. That's just a stunning thing. And that is alluded to in the New Testament, in Hebrews 11, 37. Well, no wonder Isaiah is the most quoted prophet. You could say he's the most inspirational as far as that goes. Now let's come back to Isaiah's sons. Mahershalal Hashbaz, quick to the plunder, swift to the spoil, or something like that. I give you the exact translation in the notes. This is the message of judgment. We don't trust the Lord through foreign agents, through armies of unbelievers. We will be punished. I'm not saying we'll be punished in our nation through armies of unbelievers. I'm talking about the people of God in the Old Testament. That's that message of judgment. And yet there is hope. He has the son She'ar Yashub. That is, a remnant will return. A remnant will come back. Yes, the boom will fall. There will be punishment. But one day, the people will return. And there will be a new beginning. She'ar Yashuv. Certainly, this was the message of Jesus Christ. The judgment day is at hand. We need to repent. But the gospel has good news as well. So in the Old Testament, there's the hard news and there's the happy news. There's the bad news and the good news. Mahershalal Chashbaz and Shear Yashuv, the message of judgment and hope. It's our message too. But then there's the third son, Emmanuel. God with us, or literally with us, God. We must always remember that God is with us, and above all, He's with us in our true Emmanuel, Jesus Christ. As we move to the end of this lesson, I'd like to say something about being prophetic. Finding the balance between being prophetic, courageous, and being personal and compassionate is not easy. You may ask me, yes, I was wondering, Douglas, tell us where the balance is. I'm not really sure. I know Jesus lived with that perfect balance. I find it much easier just to get to the point. For me, sad to say it, but it's easier for me just to be harsh and fast, and that's much easier than being kind and compassionate. So I want to be a prophet like Isaiah. I don't think I'm directly inspired by God, obviously, but I want to be courageous and prophetic. I tend to err more on the side of being a bit too strong, and others may err on the side of being far too diplomatic. You know, mastering the art of almost saying something. If we can combine the courage and humility of Isaiah, I think we'll be doing well. I like the way Thomas a Kempis put it 600 years ago. Be not angry that you cannot make others as you wish them to be, since you cannot make yourself as you wish to be. Oh, I like the way he's put that. Be not angry that you cannot make others as you wish them to be, since you cannot make yourself as you wish to be. Well, it's kind of a reflection on Matthew 7, verses 1 to 5. There needs to be that humility. And yet, we shouldn't be so humble that we have nothing to say. And I'm going to return to Abraham Heschel's book, The Prophets, and read one of my favorite excerpts from any book I've ever read. And it's about the prophets. And this excerpt is called The Blast of Heaven. And I'd like to read most of it as we move towards the end of the lesson. To a person endowed with prophetic sight, everyone else appears blind. To a person whose ear perceives God's voice, everyone else appears deaf. No one is just. No knowing is strong enough, no trust complete enough. The prophet hates the approximate. He shuns the middle of the road. Man must live on the summit to avoid the abyss. There's nothing to hold to except God. Carried away by the challenge, the demand to straighten out man's ways, the prophet is strange, one-sided, and unbearable extremist. Others may suffer from the terror of cosmic aloneness. The prophet is overwhelmed by the grandeur of divine presence. He's incapable of isolating the world. There's an interaction between man and God, which to disregard is an act of insolence. Isolation is a fairy tale. The prophet disdains those for whom God's presence is comfort and security. To him, it is a challenge, an incessant demand. God is compassion, not compromise, justice, though not inclemency. The prophet's predictions can always be proved wrong by a change in man's conduct, but never the certainty that God is full of compassion. The prophet's word is a scream in the night, while the world is at ease and asleep. The prophet feels the blast from heaven. That passage has touched me through the years. And when I think of Isaiah, I'm reminded of it. What do we learn about God from our lesson? Probably more than I've been able to put into these few points I'll close on. But I have four observations. First, and I almost hesitate to say it because it sounds cheap. It sounds, how can you even talk about God in a meaningful way with these kinds of adjectives? Let me just go. God is glorious, awesome, and holy. That's the first thing we see. He's awesome. Second, his presence is overwhelming, even terrifying. Don't listen to others who minimize that. Third, he longs to be gracious to us. And fourth, those he touches and cleanses, he sends to deliver his message. Those he touches and cleanses, the Lord sends out to bring the news.